This week on Unceded Airwaves, we are rebroadcasting the public lecture, Access to Justice and Indigenous Laws, organized by Green College UBC. This lecture features Val Napoleon from the University of Victoria, who is the Law Foundation Chair of Aboriginal Justice and Governance, Director, Indigenous Law Research Unit, and Provost's Engaged Community Scholar. Val Napoleon will be in conversation with Hadley Friedland, who is in the Faculty of Law at the University of Alberta. Val and Hadley have previously worked together in Indigenous Law at the University of Victoria. The premise of this lecture is to explore justice as a living concept born and reborn through time, in every place and in every society. Law, including Indigenous Law, is one way people aspire to achieve justice. But how do Indigenous legal aspirations and legal reasoning form justice today? And how may Indigenous justice concepts reconcile with Canadian state justice concepts? Stay with Unceded Airwaves for this special segment on access to justice and Indigenous laws. Thank you to Green College UBC for allowing us to syndicate this programming, and to the lecturers for allowing us to rebroadcast their voices. You may find more information on Green College and their Access to Justice lecture series on their website at greencollege.ubc.ca. We'll also post a link to their website in the description of this podcast and on our Unceded Airwaves Facebook and Twitter pages.
Good evening, everyone. We're delighted that you could all be here for the Green College Access to Justice Speaker Series tonight. I'm Mary Liston. I'm one of the co-organizers of the series, and I'm a professor of public law at Allard School of Law, just up the hill. The other organizer is Andrew Pillier, over here, who is one of our fantastic doctoral students, and whose work is actually focused on access to justice and solving that problem in Canada. Before we begin the talk, we first want to recognize that we are on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. And we'd like to invite Gail Sparrow, before we introduce our speakers, who is the former Musqueam chief and counselor and current elder in residence at Langara College, to share some words with us. So I'll pass the microphone over to you, Gail.
Thank you. First off, I just want to recognize you've got a raven there. And I'm a sparrow, so I guess it's got a lot to do with birds tonight. Anyway, I'd say to you, Itchiwail, my CMs, which is we are a word of warm welcome from the Musqueam First Nations. We add on CM when we know it's an important event or it's an important program that one's attending. So we know that this class is important to learn about justice and governance. And so I add that on because it's a little bit of homework about what this class is. Just like you said, that Musqueam First Nations community is close by. Does anyone know where the Musqueam community is in this class? Where is the Musqueam community that you know of? Where's our land and our homeland? Right here, yes, that's right. I'm glad you answered that way, because my grandfather gave me a big history on Musqueams. Our history and where we live is written right in the very earth, right here at UBC. We still have not given up our lands of recognizing where we once resided, where we once lived, and where our people's true history is in the very lands here at UBC and the city of Vancouver. I like to call Vancouver Musqueam, because you know, we're the capital of Vancouver, Musqueam. Our people resided since time immemorial, we know that. Musqueam right now today is located just southwest, I guess we go east of here, around a 10-minute drive on the right-hand side off of Salish Drive. An acreage of 400 acres is the main village site. As you know now, Musqueam is one of the most richest bands in Canada with the lands that we've acquired back through settlements, are actually having to buy our lands back jointly with the Squamish Tsleil-Waututh Nation. We become again one of the most progressive bands in Canada because we have realized that sometimes we can get the land returned back to us, but a vehicle of buying it back is good because of the economic base that we are also striving to achieve in our community. Musqueam community has a population of 1,400 people. And today, most of our people are striving and growing in economics, education, and we're prospering richly again back in our own traditional territory and lands. We call it life beyond Marine Drive now. We never used to go out of the community, but now it's changed, and so now our boundaries is life beyond Marine Drive. And Vancouver, the city of Vancouver, is located right in the heart of which was a village. We call our village site Tsunawith, which means house of learning. We didn't reside in Western type of homes. We always had longhouses. That's where our house of governance was. And in the longhouses, it was the women, the matriarchs, who governed. And my grandfather taught me that my grandmother and great-grandmother, when he resided there, that they're the ones that decided on a daily basis when they got up what the men were to do, to hunt, to fish, to gather, to, you know, raise the children, to help raise the children, prepare what was needed for the day. And they made the rules. And they were very organized, very, very organized. And I remember as a young girl that what I had to do was sweep the dirt floors in the longhouses. And I used to wonder, why do I have to sweep the dirt floors? And I was taught, because it's the very earth underneath you. You look after the earth will look after you. And I was taught that by my grandmother. And so to this day, my own place that I have, I actually still sweep the earth. I keep the ground clean because I know the very foundation of my life is where we rose up from, was from Mother Earth. The Musqueam people, again, are jointly working with Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh in the adventures to tripartite agreements of claiming our land back. And as you know, there's a lot of territories now that we have, Jericho Park. We have areas out in Wellington, and we're doing joint ventures. So we'll be prospering and growing, and hopefully one day, too, we'll be just as equal with the very partners we are in here with in Vancouver, the city of Vancouver, that recognize the importance of what we lost. A lot of people don't know this, but when they did reserve allocations, the Musqueam community only got 5 acres per head because where they're located. The other bands and tribes, when they did reserve allocations, got 10 acres per head. So that's why we're kind of unique that we're claiming back our lands, because we weren't fairly granted our reserve status of per acreage. We're only giving 5 acres. So that's why we're so going forward now, realizing that we did not get a fair allocation. So the settlements is the way to go, and the developments is the way to go. So we're prospering, we're strong, we exist. And as you know, University of British Columbia is actually a site where Musqueam used to have point guards run from the village site, 10 miles from here, up to the very point to watch to see what tribes were coming down the river, to see whether it was the Haida Gwaii, who were very powerful people, say they're coming to trade to be friendly, or the people from Bella Coola, where they trade to be friendly. And we had warriors that would run out, and they'd come back to the village. We didn't have texting and all these modern technology, but they communicated. They came back and prepared the village, whether it was one that was friendly or not so friendly. So the very footprints are all over this territory of village sites at the university. So it's rich and prosperous for the university beyond the very lands that Musqueam occupied as village sites. So we recognize that. We haven't given that up. That's what we call it, unceded territory. In our minds, our history is still right here written in the earth, the very foundation of this university. The Langara College now has a name called Tsleil-Waututh, which means House of Teachings. It's now Langara College. Again, Musqueam is extended out to be inclusive, to say, to recognize in the institutes and the post-secondary the existence of the very people who resided in those territories and in those lands. So it's very inclusive. In our family today, Musqueam people also were the very first. They were the very first to have the youngest chief in council in Canada, the very first female chief elected to office in Canada, the first band manager in Canada, the first ever lease. Prior to our lease, we lived in very hard times. When I was growing up, we never had running water and electricity. We used outhouses. And I've seen the change come forward because we leased up the lands to the Asians, and the Asian people were not allowed to lease land also. So by doing that, the lease money that came in, we built our infrastructure, the water, the electrical, the road improvements, and also the housing. And then we eventually, because of the lease development of Parcel A and B, which Cynthia lives on, she's my neighbor here, she's across the street, afforded us to be able to build the first ever village in Canada. With the $15,000 revenue base, where the people are asked, what do you want to do with the money? Do you want to put it in your pocket, or do you want to build your own home? And a grade one home, by the way. The people decided, we will build our own homes, because there were government standard homes before. And thus Musqueam began the journey of being a progressive moving band and started the first economic base of land development and holding the first ever lease in Canada. And now they're still setting the same tread today. Without a past, you don't have a future. So from our past that we have, we now have a better future. And it's the land base that's our strength that we have today as a community. We too seek for justice too for our people. We still strive to see changes in our governance. There's lots to change yet, but we are striving to do that by the ways of our people becoming educated. We have now more people that are entering into law, to administration, to business, and self-govern. My grandfather taught me was governing yourself first. So we're grasping onto that again and taking over ownership and going forward. So like I say, Musqueam people have always been a welcoming people. We're always people that are honored that when they include us in their events and their programs and whatever they're doing to recognize the First Peoples of Canada. Because we were here first, and for a long time we were last, but now we're coming first again. So Musqueam people are saying to you, Haichka, for welcoming us, asking us to welcome you here tonight. We leave with you our blessings that you will learn something new to make you better in your sojourn in your life. And my grandfather died during my tenure as chief. And he said to me, I felt sorry for you, Gail. You don't have an Indian name. And he called me to his home and he said, Amit, sit down. And I said, what are you going to do, grandfather? And he said, well, he's 100 years old. And he had a sense of humor. And he said, in forms when you meet people, I want you to make sure you leave them happy. And we have humor, which keeps us going also. So he said to me, in American way, they have chief with many horses, chief with many goats. And you, my dear one, don't have a husband. I bless on you, chief looking for a husband. He left me that name during my tenure as chief. It didn't work. I'm still chief looking for a husband, or former chief looking for a husband. But that was one of the things that I even introduced myself. Unfortunately, some of the men that lined up, I wanted to be not chief looking for a husband. But I'm grateful that I had that great learning experience and the wisdom of my grandfather that's carried me to this day. And he left that humor. It is also so important to us to leave a little joke, to leave a little laughter wherever we go. So that's my gift also in this opening, this welcoming. So from the Musqueam First Nations, we say to you, Haichka RCMs, for recognizing us and including us here tonight in this class of justice and governance. And you're in good hands when you have a raven, you know, as a theme, and you have a sparrow, you know, welcoming and closing you. So on that note, can we all raise our hands and say, Haichka? Okay, RCMs. On that note, Haichka again. Thank you very much.
Haichka Gail, thank you so very much for sharing those words with us. And I think we all hope we're on the same path going forward together from now on in Canada. Tonight's talk is the last in this term's Access to Justice Speakers series, and it's going to be a good one. We're delighted to introduce our two fantastic speakers. Dr. Val Napoleon joins us from the University of Victoria, where she's the Law Foundation Professor of Aboriginal Justice and Governance. Her current research focuses on Indigenous legal traditions, legal theories, feminisms, citizenship, self-determination, and of course, governance. Several of her major initiatives have included establishing the Indigenous Law Research Unit, of which Professor Friedland is also a member, and developing a proposed JID, a dual JD and Indigenous Law degree at UVic, which is a very exciting and important initiative for Canada. She works with numerous Indigenous community partners here in BC and in other parts on a range of Indigenous law research projects like water law, legal remedies for harms and injuries, gender in Indigenous law, and lands and resources. She also works with several national and international Indigenous law research initiatives. She teaches widely at UVic, and some of her courses are Indigenous Feminist Legal Studies, Property, Indigenous legal theories, and Indigenous legal methodologies. She is from Salto First Nation in Northeast BC, covered by BC Treaty 8, and is an adopted member of the House of Luchon, Ganada or Frog Clan, from Gitanyau, Northern Gitsan. Our second speaker is Dr. Hadley Friedland, who is currently a visiting assistant professor at the Faculty of Law, University of Alberta. Her research and teaching focuses on Indigenous laws, legal methodologies, pedagogies, Aboriginal law, criminal justice, family, and child welfare law. She also does work in dispute resolution and therapeutic jurisprudence. She was the research director of the UVic Indigenous Law Research Unit from 2012 to 2016, and I encourage you to check out their website. It is fantastic, and they do a lot of great work. And she is co-creator with Dr. Val Napoleon of the main methodology that that unit uses. They do a lot of work on pedagogy and teaching materials, and so for those of you who are interested in that, you'll find a lot of good stuff on that website. She has worked extensively with Indigenous communities across Canada and has collaborated to produce accessible Indigenous legal resources for Indigenous communities, legal professionals, and the general public. She's dedicated to experiential community-based training and continuing legal education, and I can tell you're a fantastic teacher. So we look forward to seeing some of that in action here.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcast from the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's episode is a broadcast of a lecture given by Dr. Val Napoleon and Dr. Hadley Friedland. Their lecture was titled Access to Justice and Indigenous Laws and was given on November 23rd as part of Green College's ongoing lecture series, Access to Justice.
We're excited to bring Val and Hadley back together again. We understand it's been a little while since they worked together, so it's a nice reunion for the both of them, and we're benefiting from the good vibes that they're going to generate, I think. So without any further words, let's turn it over to our speakers, beginning with Val.
Thank you for the welcome to these lands. That enables us to start this work, this talk in a good way. And thank you, Mary and others, for the invitation here. And it's really good to see some old friends and some new friends and friends yet to be, and so thank you. I'd like to begin by introducing the raven that Gail commented on. This is a trickster raven. She's a grandmother. She is a feminist born of national and international Indigenous feminist consciousness, and she exists in part because often the way that tricksters, who I understand to be the first law teachers, often tricksters these days are characterized mainly as male, and so there needs to be a grandmother trickster to slap us upside the head when we take ourselves too seriously. At least she slaps me upside the head quite often. So, and the other thing is, I heard somewhere, and I don't actually know if it's true, maybe you can tell me at the end of the night, I heard that we listen better if we have something to look at. So here you go, you'll have things to look at as we go through. So what we want to do with this talk is situate a concept of justice within Indigenous law in a way that makes the context and Indigenous law itself visible. So we want to do an exploration of how might we understand justice, how might we situate it, and how does Indigenous law matter to how we think about justice. And there are three things that we want to do with this. Is one, explore the context. To just look at what might Indigenous justice mean if we take seriously Indigenous law. And then the third thing is we want to speak specifically about one legal tradition, Cree law. So that's the work that we'll go through tonight. And what we hope to do is to provoke your questions and some of the discussion, and we want to make sure that we have enough time to do that. So so we'll welcome that.
Now it's on? Yeah, okay. I'm just going to remain seated because of a leg injury, but if people can't hear me, just let me know and look at the picture if you can't see me. So some of that context, for many years we've been working in partnership with Indigenous communities. And what we've been doing, and really I was trying to think when we started, probably 2010, Val? Maybe even 2009. And we've been working in collaboration with Indigenous communities to research Indigenous laws in a way where we can substantively articulate Indigenous legal principles. And this includes responses, this includes legal institutions, and this includes legal processes. And our starting point for that research is always saying, through time, every society across time and space has had to deal with conflict, violence, and vulnerabilities. There's no society that does not have to deal with those things. And in fact, we know our heart for legal theorists in the room say that that's a core of law in any society, right? We must deal with those issues. So law is a distinct mode of governance. It stands out from other modes of governance. And it is connected to all societies' social and economic and political life, but it's distinct. So we deal with human problems. If human beings live together, there are going to be universal issues. It doesn't matter where or when. But each society has societally specific responses to those universal human issues. So that's our starting point. And when we're thinking about justice, we're thinking about those societal specific responses to universal human issues. And we're thinking about the aspirations of a society, what that society imagines life is for and what law is for. And we know that when societies aspire for justice, they work through those aspirations with law. So sometimes people will talk about our justice system, which everybody knows is perfect. No. wait a minute. Wait a minute. But sometimes when people are working with clients going through the justice system, a lawyer will say to a client, listen, this is a legal system, not a justice system. Let's start over. But we know that we use our law to reach towards justice.
So we've worked across Canada with different legal orders, with Mi'kmaq peoples, Anishinaabeg, Cree, Tsilhqot'in, Squamish, Coast Salish, and Tsimshian, a lot of different places, Gekxan, and so on. And there are, as Hadley said, how people organize their law and expressions of law, the structure of it is different. But there are some aspirations that we can see arising out of the way that people organize themselves in order to manage their collective human life. And the kinds of things that people care about, which comes through the way that people act on legal problems, are things like community safety, are things like fairness, human agency, and often agency is understood in terms of individual agency, but also collective agency, depending on the different structures through which law operates. There's inclusion and inclusion with law insofar as harms and injuries. Inclusion means people who've committed harms and those who've been harmed and those people around them. And human dignity, the way that how people are treated. And you can see that there's also requirements for kindness and gentleness around people, which really emphasizes the importance of human dignity in what people are trying to do. So these are some of the aspirations, the things that people are wanting to work toward, those things that are right and wrong. But here's the thing, nobody ever lives up to their aspirations. But what is really important is that we have an opportunity to try. And it's one of the reasons that it's so important to understand law as a part of a human society. So the late Nils Christie argued that one of the most important things was the right to determine what what's good and what's not good in a society when humans live together. And he was saying that if people lose that right, if that ability to determine what they care about and what's right and what's wrong, if that's taken away from them, they're going to become paralyzed. So he was talking about industrialization and the growth of the state and the centralized power of the state in Scandinavia. But I think what he was talking about, we can understand as also being reflected in indigenous communities. So, in other words, how might the colonial suppression of indigenous law suppress the ability of indigenous communities to set out their normative commitments, to set out what they care about and to organize themselves in a way that they could act on what they care about. So that, and how might that fundamental denial of being lawful peoples, how might that fundamental denial contribute to the violence that's experienced in some of our communities, what we might understand as lawlessness in some places. We know that many of our communities are experiencing high levels of internal conflict. I mean, it's not the only thing, obviously, that's going on in our communities, but it is part of the reality. So we also know that Indigenous law hasn't gone anywhere in Canada, but the ground is uneven. And there are gaps, and there are distortions in some cases. And depending on where you are in Canada, the kinds of experiences that you have insofar as the suppression, the role of the state, that's going to vary. So there's nowhere where there's going to be a complete, intact legal order ready to spring to life through recognition. And what this means for us, for all of us, for this generation of Indigenous peoples, for future generations of Indigenous peoples, is that the work is about rebuilding Indigenous legal orders, and rebuilding Indigenous law. So that's, you know, and when we think about that, then we need to start thinking about how will that work take place.
And I think when we think of how this work takes place, we naturally turn to the law that is visible and recognizable in Canada today. And there are areas within Canadian law where there are points of connection and opportunity for conversation with Indigenous laws. And for there to be a really rich, fertile ground for that rebuilding to be taking place. So some of the examples that come up in the Canadian justice system, Aboriginal title, treaties, duty to consult cases, Section 9124 of the Constitution Act, the Charter and Equality, there's cases, there's issues that arise. Self-determination and governance. I was recently meeting with some really lovely federal court judges, and they were talking about how often issues around banned elections come before them, and how open they are to working through some processes that would come from the Indigenous societies that they are seeing before them. So there's opportunity there and need to do that. There's historic claims, there's international law, there's domestic laws. Water is, if you want to jump in on that one, because you're doing kind of that cool water project. We haven't worked together for a while. We have to catch up here in front of you.
Well, yeah. there are different, there's the new Water Sustainability Act, and one of the projects that we're working with is the substantive articulation of Indigenous water law in three regions of water scarcity. And that's one stream of research. The second stream of research is looking at informal, non-Indigenous law, because the way that people behave, non-Indigenous water users, doesn't map onto formal legislation. So how might we understand the different kinds of actions and agreements regarding allocation and sharing and so on that are taking place around the province? And then the third stream is looking at the Water Sustainability Act and the problems with it, and trying to figure out with the different regions how might we build water stewardship that acts on, that allows Indigenous law to be a part of the management, part of the decision making, and in a way that can find their points of collaboration with state law, but also non-Indigenous water users. So it's a three-year project. So those are the kinds of ways that Indigenous people all over are very pragmatically are looking to act on Indigenous law wherever there are opportunities that they can find.
And I think another way is impact benefit agreements. Sometimes you see that. You see economic projects where people are saying, we don't necessarily just want to take something from outside and follow along a cookie cutter path to economic development that's been developed that hasn't been based on our own aspirations and norms. We want to build something from the ground up. So there's a lot of diverse work going on. There's also within the criminal justice system, there are community justice programs. There's a GLADU line of cases and the space there for courts and for processes that open up the space for some conversations with Indigenous law. And there too, a pressing need that we've heard from the Supreme Court. So there's spaces within the Canadian justice system, and those are just some examples, but just to show the span and the complexity within the justice system.
And each of those has its advantages and disadvantages. I'm sure that some of you would already know that. The impact benefit agreements, for example, if we understand them from a Canadian law perspective as something akin to a contract, and understood within the rubric of private law, the line in Canadian law of private and public shifts for all kinds of reasons, depending on who's doing the analysis. But ultimately, if we understand it as being within private law and can be understood as a contract, the content of those agreements are actually public insofar as Indigenous law. And so those are the kinds of points where there has to be very careful thinking through about the consequences of the forms that are available. So there's all kinds of additional questions that they raise. So we've been working with communities on harms and injuries. We're going to give you an example of that on lands and resources. And what we find is that when we do the work, say, on lands and resources, the work will expand into conflict management and will expand into governance and often will expand into dealing with gender, issues of gender in Indigenous law, because the work that Indigenous communities are doing is complex. And Indigenous law includes the full scope of law, all that's necessary to manage human life. And so in looking at dispute resolution on several of the projects, what we can see is that there are a number of options available to Indigenous communities. There are the regular courts that and lots of Indigenous peoples go to court for good reason. There are therapeutic courts, and those are, you know, there's a whole range of different kinds of therapeutic courts that are being established. There are tribunals. There are the range of alternative dispute resolution options. There are community justice options, and then there are Indigenous law options. All of those things are available to Indigenous peoples, and all of them have strengths and weaknesses. Part of the difficulty is that when communities are organizing to take on different aspects of governance or different kinds of questions that, part of some of the struggles that people are dealing with, is that those forms, whether it's therapeutic courts or community justice projects, will be taken on with the assumption that that then becomes Indigenous law. And Indigenous law actually hasn't been substantively developed and doesn't actually influence that form of decision making in any real substantive way. So there's that kind of, I mean, those are huge undertakings for communities, and people are in all different places all across the country. When we did that project for matrimonial real property on reserve and looked at dispute resolution, and Hadley and another person from the research unit were looking at what was going on across Canada. It was a huge, huge range of different ways that people were acting on their legal obligations in the spaces that were available to them.
And if I can jump in there, I mean, I do think that's the insight. When we say these forms can push or actually end up restricting Indigenous laws when that substantive work hasn't been done, we do see, and we saw that there weren't bright lines. It's not court or Indigenous law necessarily. What we see is that where there is space for Indigenous peoples to be reasoning and thinking things through and talking and resolving disputes, there is Indigenous law work happening, as Val said. And our work is to make that explicit, to pull that out and to build that scaffolding underneath it for substantive conversations that can go beyond particular individuals.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcast from the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's episode is a broadcast of a lecture given by Dr. Val Napoleon and Dr. Hadley Friedland. Their lecture was titled Access to Justice and Indigenous Laws and was given on November 23rd as part of Green College's ongoing lecture series, Access to Justice.
So one example of community justice, and some, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the language of restorative justice, just in terms of what law is visible or not. Some years ago, one of my brothers committed a serious crime, and he was incarcerated. And part of what was really important for my family was to facilitate a process for him so that there would be a way to acknowledge the harms done to the two victims in the robberies that he harmed. And the process that was available to us was restorative justice. We created that around him. This isn't a story with a happy ending. There were happy moments along with continuing addictions and homelessness. So the idea of recounting this is just to look at what happened in that one instance with one Cree man. And so even though we included, you know, my grandmother and so on as part of that, there was no evidence of Cree law. I mean, what becomes really, really apparent, and this is a number of years ago now, is that there are these community processes, and those processes are within and against state law completely and fully. And what happens is that Indigenous law can completely disappear in them. So what's powerful are Canadian legal institutions through which law operates, and what hasn't been rebuilt for us yet or wasn't in that situation were Cree legal institutions through which Cree law could operate. And so there are these continuing situations of asymmetry where you have all of state law on one side and aspirations or philosophy or gaps on the other side, where people can't pull or draw on all that the intellectual traditions and to contextualize the problems that they're trying to deal with within their own indigenous law. So that's just one, one example that's repeated all the time in those asymmetrical instances that go on with indigenous law. So what should be available to us as indigenous peoples insofar as those intellectual resources, those ways of understanding and finding meaning and dealing with harms and injuries, then aren't available. And that's the challenge. They have to be available in a way that's practicable.
Because what is visible, and we were talking about this a little earlier today when we were catching up, what is visible and what doesn't rely on proving that recidivism rates go down or all these kind of the happy endings where something like restorative justice sometimes longs for or seeks is the fact that the Canadian justice system just exists as a mass of fact. It just stays visible and people reason through it and that is the form that justice takes. It's present everywhere and the presence of Indigenous law and Indigenous legal reasoning is not as visible. So through the Indigenous Law Research Unit, our work has been about that rebuilding and visibility. And we've completed a number of major research projects. We've worked with over 40 communities. Wow. No wonder we're busy. That's a lot. And many different legal traditions. So taking a similar approach, but approaching each community and each Indigenous legal tradition as a unique system of thinking and reasoning through justice. The project that we want to focus on today is the Accessing Justice and Reconciliation Project, where we worked with several communities across Canada looking specifically at legal responses to harms and injuries. And generally, what we found, we spend a lot of time and we say, you have to be specific. And the first time we presented on this project, we said, it's so specific, it's so different. The Mi'kmaq and the Coast Salish have such different legal traditions. And the first question we have, so this is just a warning, in case you're thinking of asking this, was, but could you just tell us a common theme? So we're gonna preempt that question and just say that there were some common themes. There was generally within Indigenous legal traditions, just like there's some common aspirations for justice and the work of law, there were some common legal themes that emerged insofar as responding to harms and injuries, from healing to compensation to reconciliation, to sanctions and incapacitation when community safety was an issue. There was a range. And this is important because at this point in history and for quite a long time now, the state has assumed a monopoly on legal responses to serious issues. The state maintains a monopoly on the use of coercive force. So when force is required, when force separation is required, that is in the hands of the state. And that leaves legal responses to communities less serious harms. And so what's very common for people that have a criminal justice background is they'll talk about summary offenses. And they'll say, well, you can only, this community justice project can go up and running, but there's going to be certain rules around it. And it can only deal with summary offenses, or it can only deal with nonviolent offenses, there'll be all these rules put around it saying that when there's an Aboriginal justice project, serious harms and injuries are excluded from that. And in fact, often when people talk about Indigenous law, and this is very common, if you Googled, if you guys were a class of students right now, I'd tell you, Google Aboriginal justice. See what you find. And you will likely find that often Aboriginal justice is described as if there are no legitimate legal responses to serious harms. And this is really important because we know from the statistics, Indigenous peoples are facing serious harms. There are serious harms within Indigenous communities and within non-Indigenous society targeted towards Indigenous peoples. What Indigenous peoples don't have is the legitimacy and the resources that the state has to respond to serious harms. And if we think logically, if we go back historically, we can say it wouldn't make logical sense that historically Indigenous laws were restricted only to healing. Often you hear that Indigenous law is about healing and harmony. And what follows is, I mean, so that can't deal with a serious offense. I mean, that can't deal with somebody that I'm trying to think of a good example that's not too gruesome. But Indigenous law is not going to deal with someone that broke in here and robbed us all at gunpoint. Let's say that happened tonight. That's not going to be something that you can sit and heal and sit in a circle and talk about. So Indigenous law can't touch that. That will be dealt with by the mainstream justice system. But if there was a pickpocket here, like, I hope now everyone's going to be worried about your coat. you find out at the end that a wallet was stolen and you find out that it's a poor young guy walking down the street here and maybe then you could sit and talk about that in a circle. And as we talk about that, I what's really important to note there is that what has happened over time is a characterization of Indigenous laws as not being able to handle more serious offenses. And that's, again, it's illogical historically. We can think about that. We know across time and societies, serious offenses happen. And we can also think of the damage that does and the restrictions that start being built around Indigenous responses. This is a state-imposed limit. And maybe it should stay a state-imposed limit. We can debate that. But it's really important to note this is not an inherent limit in any Indigenous legal tradition. So within Indigenous law, there are a range of legitimate responses to harms and injuries. And some of them will look like healing, will look like that. Wouldn't people imagine that circle? And some of them may look very different. Some of them may look much more similar to something like incarceration or temporary removal from society.
So one of the consequences of describing Indigenous law as only being about one end of the spectrum of the full responses to harms and injuries is to deny the possibility of an intellectual life whereby people collaboratively reason through in a principled way how to respond to harms and injuries that are more serious. So, and it suggests that that Indigenous peoples weren't intellectual, but rather only behaved in certain ways. In fact, I've heard people say that it's about the behavior and it's about people being in a certain way. So there's, obviously some problems with that approach. So it is possible, so there are all different kinds of things that people are doing. Communities are working really hard wherever they can. And it is possible to locate different justice programs or different ways of dealing with conflict or so on within the spectrum of legitimate indigenous legal responses. It's possible to do that, but only if you've got a symmetrical relationship where you've done the homework of articulating indigenous law in its fullness and in its scope, so that it isn't just so that it doesn't remain invisible. In fact, one of the tasks in doing this work is to see the invisibility of indigenous law. So rather than assuming that it's absent, then to look at and ask questions about that invisibility. That's part of the work. And so we need to imagine indigenous law and legal processes around every indigenous person in every indigenous community. Again, it's back to that idea of restoring indigenous law and rebuilding it in the community as live processes, complete with institutions and legal processes through which people collaboratively act. One of the ways that we can understand violence and things like missing and murdered indigenous women and girls, one way we can understand that is as places where there's a lapse of indigenous law as well as a lapse of Canadian law, where there's those spaces where violence and sexualized violence against indigenous women and girls can happen. And so that idea of building lawfulness as a way to create safe communities then has, you know, can start with that particular perspective. There's no room for idealization of indigenous law or indigenous peoples in doing this work. It's hard work and it's complicated work. And the other piece of that in terms of the challenges is that there's always the promise of law, those things that we want to achieve with it, those things that we care about and what we want for our families and our grandchildren and people that we love. But there's also the potential failure of it. And so it means asking hard questions, and it means asking things like when law is described in certain ways that, which is more like a dictatorship, or where people's human rights, according to indigenous law, are not respected, of challenging whether what's being talked about is actually law, questioning the legality of some descriptions of indigenous law. And that means doing a lot of homework and a lot of thinking and talking with communities, with our families and with all of us to enable us to be able to do that. One of the ways to begin the conversations around things like controversial issues or conflicts or things that our communities have to deal with is, are they legal according to indigenous law? And how do you know that? What homework have you done collectively so that you can be informed about that kind of analysis of questions? So the promise and the potential failure of law, like we know that law is always connected to the power dynamics that's a part of what happens when human beings live together. So state law has failed us at different times in the past and continues to do so. Every system of law has a potential of failure, and we've seen that in other parts of the world as well. Those big challenges of law exist for Indigenous people in the work of rebuilding Indigenous law for ourselves and our communities.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcast from the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's episode is a broadcast of a lecture given by Dr. Val Napoleon and Dr. Hadley Friedland. Their lecture was titled Access to Justice and Indigenous Laws and was given on November 23rd as part of Green College's ongoing lecture series, Access to Justice.
So our work has been deeply informed by reality, by looking at the pressing reality and saying, how do we deal with these conditions of vulnerability and violence that are leading to tragedies like the reality of murdered and missing Indigenous women in Canada. We haven't had a lot of time for abstract, idealized, theoretical discussions, even though we love it, because the pressing reality of today is right there. So our starting point is wanting to take Indigenous law seriously as law, which means that it's going to take the same or more work to engage and understand and grapple with any Indigenous law, any legal category within any Indigenous legal tradition, as it takes for first-year law students to come into law school and grapple with criminal law, or grapple with learning contracts or constitutional law. What you see up on the screen is one Indigenous legal methodology. It's taking an analytical framework and saying, let's walk through and approach Indigenous law as law. Let's look at it as a comprehensive whole, but we also want to pull out the particulars, because that's what you need to do to be able to access and understand and apply laws. So I'll give you the example. When I started law school, I had an assignment in my criminal law class, and we were all supposed to go watch a trial at the courthouse. And everybody got really excited because there was a murder trial at the courthouse. And how many people here have watched? Perry Mason is really old, but I'm just watching him right now. But has anyone watched a Perry Mason or a Law and Order? Or, you know, we have a lot of TV shows about murder trials, and they're pretty dramatic. They can rivet you for an hour. Not so much the family of the victim or the accused, right? But all these eager law students were really excited, so they were going to go watch this murder trial, just like, I know Perry Mason, I'm really dating myself, but Perry Mason is really not even, but, you know, Law and Order, they were all excited, right? And what happened is all the law students went into the trial and were bored stiff. Because the reality is, for anyone that sat through a trial, it doesn't really matter how exciting the substantive issue is. A lot of law is quite boring. And so part of my aspiration, which may seem a little bit counterintuitive, is to say, well, couldn't we make Cree law as boring as state law? and so you'll forgive us to switch tracks here and take on our law professor hats and try to bore you a bit. And that's what this analytical framework does, is say we need to draw out these bits of law that are crucial to aspirations of justice, are crucial to solving problems, but maybe are a bit boring to work through. But really, we need that level of precision. We need to be looking for legal precedents, and we, because there's such a deep absence and absence of resources, we can't go to computers, there's not libraries full of books that we can easily grab on, and there's a missing of literacy, learning from the land or learning from spiritual means. There's a deep absence of the scaffolding in most places to learn that way. So we wanted to have a systemic, methodical analysis using a standardized way of approaching law and be able to start drawing out law. And we cite every source. I think there are some people in this room that have had the misfortune of working with us, and they might tell you, they might agree with us that we are we're pretty strong about that, Aval. You cite every source. You do not make a statement about Indigenous law and say this is the way it is without showing where it came from, which is what we expect of law students in law school.
So just on that. So sometimes we draw on oral histories and stories as the form of legal precedent. The question asked of those is determined by the community, but sometimes students would say, well, actually, you know, they write in harmony or whatever else into their analysis. And so we'd say, where in the story does it say harmony? Right? Because that's an assumption. It has to be, and you have, and that you cite your sources so that people can go to those same sources and say, actually, I have a different interpretation than you do. It's a fundamental democratization of law and legal process is part of what it is. And so the reports that are created, the reports and casebooks for the community, because then it's theirs, is anywhere from 70 to 300 pages, depending on the subject matter of the legal reports that are created for the communities.
So we can probably move on. We don't want to walk through. Do we want to walk through that, Val?
You still can.
The specifics? I mean, so these are the categories, and what we always say about this framework, we kind of have these questions, and it's just a way of approaching many diverse sources and diverse legal traditions. But the really important part about this framework is that it's a framework, period. It's not that these questions are the very best questions, the very only questions that can be asked, but it serves as a framework to look at that whole picture. So looking at legal processes, looking at what are the characteristics of legitimate decision making, who are the decision makers that count, that can make a decision that people accept, even if they don't agree with the result. That's an important part of any law, is to know that. What are the procedural steps? This is law students' favorite part of law school, learning those. But it's crucial, right? Again, for the same issue. Looking at legal responses and resolutions, what principles govern the appropriate responses? When we worked, and we're going to give you examples from the Cree Legal Traditions Report, when we worked further with that Cree community, very strongly we heard from the leadership, we want, when people give responses and come up with how a problem is going to be solved or how a harm is going to be addressed, we want principled reasons. We don't want to be dealing with an issue where they're saying, oh, that's because it's that elder's grandson. Any more than Joe off the street sitting in front of a judge would want to be given a sentence that doesn't have reasons, right? Or that was, that was because, that was the judge's nephew, right? We wouldn't want that. And neither did the community that we were working with. We looked at legal obligations. What are individual and collective responsibilities? And we looked at legal rights, and rights can be a controversial term, and we've been challenged on that, but it's not really a term that's going anywhere. That's reality, it's recognizable. And what we're really saying there is what should people expect from other people to feel that things are fair and done correctly? And we looked at substantive and procedural rights. And then we also look at general underlying principles. And Val, I think your work is, if anyone's interested, Val's dissertation is really, I think, the most extensive theoretically, looking at the Gitsan legal tradition. But these general underlying principles start to get to that, to say all law has theory, all law has aspirations, and part of looking at the specifics is drawing out and recognizing there's general underlying principles or constituting principles, meta principles that we follow. So that's what we do, and we have this standardized methodical way of approaching a diversity of Indigenous legal traditions, these deep absences of resources, and a diversity of goals and questions from communities.
So this is one of four methodologies that we have. We also have lands and resources that have been developed, and one on gender, and another that is almost done on governance. So it's looking at different areas of law and how might we frame those so that they're accessible and understandable and applicable by communities to deal with the kinds of work that law has to do at the community level. So The one that we'll just focus on here, and just looking at the time, is just what's the range of legal responses and resolutions within the Cree legal traditions. And, you know, we have a number of these from different legal orders, and so this is just the one. I just wanted to point out for the decision makers within the Cree, there are four decision-making groups. There's leaders, there's medicine people, there's elders, and there's a whole community. Who is drawn on to, as an authoritative decision maker, it depends on the kind of legal problem that they're grappling with and the particular role, the way that they engage as decision makers is also determined by the kind of legal problem that's before them. For example, the elders, if there's a community danger, there's potential harm, their role is more directive. If there's no immediate harm, their role is persuasive. So it's a very nuanced way of ensuring that there's that whoever is best equipped to deal with problems, they're drawn upon. So the principle of healing, as we said, that is part of Cree legal traditions as it is for other peoples, and it is the preferred and the predominant approach to dealing with someone who's committed a harm. And what's really important, and you know, and the reason for looking at the whole range of responses is to see that different kinds of problems require different responses, and within the Cree legal traditions, there is that full range.
So another Cree legal principle is the principle of avoidance or separation, and we saw this over time. When healing wasn't possible or when somebody wasn't willing to be healed, sometimes a group would respond to harm by moving the person or by moving away from the person or by actively avoiding him or her in order to maintain group safety. In historical stories and accounts, something that was very interesting is it could just as easily be a community all packing up and leaving than sending away an individual from that community. But there's stories of both. Sometimes this is temporary, and sometimes this was more permanent. Avoidance can also be employed to avoid the escalation of conflicts, especially in a conflict situation when escalating that conflict could cause more harm than the original concern. So it's another example of a principled approach to human issues.
So there's the principle of acknowledging responsibility as a remedy, and this is, you know, like we see it here for the Cree, but it's also something within Gixan law that's a very strong part of how people respond to someone who's committed a harm. And there's compensation that or restitution that's a part of that response as well.
I was just thinking, we also see that in the criminal code, don't we? How often it's used, but it's there. We aspire to it. The principle of reintegration. So when it's possible and safe to do so, a person who has committed harms and even very grave harms is integrated or reintegrated back into the community as a fully functioning group member. This can start to risk sounding idealized, some loveliness, happy endings, and you've probably already gotten, we're not totally into that. And I think what's really important about this is it was also really clear that reintegration included ongoing observation and monitoring a person that has committed harm for warning signs that he or she might become harmful again. And this was, when we did interviews, it was striking. This was sometimes a multi-generational supervision and observation. So I was interviewing an elder, and she was talking about a woman who had become quite harmful, and she was saying that her father had helped heal her, and the woman had come back into the community. And she was talking about how her father then kept an eye on this woman and visited her and checked her because people knew it was a lifelong thing that they needed to keep checking on. And then all of a sudden, the person that was translating for me interrupted and she said, "But mom," because it was her daughter. And she said, "What happened when grandpa died?" Because this woman was still living. And her mom said, "I took over." And so the power and intensity of that, that there's that level of seriousness around reintegration, it's that valued, but it also requires that level of commitment.
There's the understanding that there can also be spiritual or natural consequences for human actions. And this is the one that often has the biggest draw for people looking at Indigenous law. There's such a want to go to the spiritual part. And I'm reminded of the Dalai Lama. Someone asked him, "Well, why don't you talk more about the spiritual stuff? Like, that's what people want to hear. It's the most important stuff." And he said, "Because if I talk about that, they're not going to hear anything else I say about poverty or about other kinds of things that are also a very real part of human experience. It becomes the magnet for human attention and takes away from the material realities of people's lives." And I sometimes think that that's kind of a similar dynamic that can happen here. And it's just like in the work that we do, we remind people over and over again that law doesn't interpret itself. Humans are always interpreting, and humans are also interpreting natural and spiritual consequences. What's important here is, humans can intervene in different ways to varying extent, but the understanding is that there's proportionality that's involved. People obviously have to figure out what that means, but it's one of the principles that's involved with understanding this particular response.
And in historical stories, before the state took over and maintained a monopoly on the use of coercive force, there were stories where people made a principled decision to incapacitate somebody that was becoming so harmful, there was simply no way to keep the community safe from that person. In cases of extreme or ongoing harms where no other response would work, sometimes there were cases of execution. There's a lot of historical court cases in the Canadian side where the people that then carried out this principled decision, no matter how much was shown of the decision-making process, were then executed by the Canadian state for their part in that. As soon as I had looked at something called Wetiko cases, and as soon as there were other options, or if there were other options available, like RCMP stations, and sometimes actually missions, somebody that was harmful and causing that much danger to the community were taken to the missions or taken to the RCMP stations. There was a story that is quite colorful where all the people had was a rope, and somebody would be tied up when he became very harmful, and once he came back into himself again, he would be untied for a period of 3 years, actually. So, but sometimes that was necessary.
So, there's some substantive rights for the Cree legal tradition: safety and protection, and the right to receive help if one is incapable or one is vulnerable, and the kinds of procedural rights. And these actually are, you could see threads of commonality across legal orders. The right to evidence, the right to an investigation, to have corroboration by evidence and observation. The right to be heard, and the right to open and collective legal processes and appropriate consultation.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcast from the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's episode is a broadcast of a lecture given by Dr. Val Napoleon and Dr. Hadley Friedland Their lecture was titled Access to Justice and Indigenous Laws and was given on November 23rd as part of Green College's ongoing lecture series, Access to Justice.
So have we bored you enough?
we're back to the pictures now.
Did it work? Because remember, that was our goal. So the idea behind this is to move beyond a denial of legality, but also moving beyond law as declaration. If you are going to use law, if you are going to be able to recognize when something is legal or when the law is broken, you need to know it in enough detail to actually work with it.
Well, it's also not telling each other what the law is without any process, because what we're seeing is where there are conflicts is people declaring law at each other, but there's no process, and they're calling on the same law, but there's no process, legal process, that's legitimate and recognized and inclusive through which people come to a legitimate decision. So some of the work that we have to do is to ask what are the conditions of legitimacy that are necessary in order for those kinds of conflicts to be resolved. So I've mentioned public legal institutions, and part of that work means looking at past public legal institutions and law and contemporary legal institutions and law, because there have been changes resulting from the Indian Act and other state legal benchmarks, and to look at where there are contradictions between past and present forms through which law operates. And so that's part of the homework of rebuilding. And I can, if you're interested in the questions, I can give some examples of what that means.
We're in a period of rebuilding. We're looking at what do we need. We don't have we don't have easy access. We don't have databases and walls of books like we do in law school when we're learning Canadian law. If Indigenous law is going to find traction, if people are going to be able to apply it to real life problems today, it has to be visible and accessible. Indigenous peoples have to be able to access it as part of being self-governing and self-determining peoples. And those who are subject to it, and those that might be charged with reviewing it or enforcing it, must be able to recognize the reasoning underlying decisions. And that's crucial for moving forward here. So here we just have some examples of the work of the Indigenous Law Research Unit. We're pretty proud of it, but we also think it's important. It's a start of building those resources. Think about how much time and energy and resources have gone into the amount of legal resources that are available for Canadian state law. So this is a start, from videos to teaching guides to toolkits. Just having some resources out there as starting points. As inspirations, well, we always hope that people will, we don't even mind if we get up people's nose and people are so irritated by what we create that they create something better. That would also make us happy, right? Either or, you can use our stuff or you can
We just finished a big project that I'm really proud of. It's a gender toolkit. So it's gender in Indigenous law. And it has an accompanying casebook with analysis from Cree, Dene, and Secwepemc law. So those, so we finished those. We can mail you electronic copies. We're trying to raise money for its publication right now. So there's.
Is it on the website already? Is it up?
Actually, I'm not sure, but it will be soon if it's not right now. And that's us.
I want to thank both Val and Hadley for an amazing presentation tonight. And I understand that we do have some time for questions until about 6:30. We'll pass around the mic if you do have a question. But I'll just mention up front that tonight's presentation is being recorded both for rebroadcast on unceded airways on CITR and for a Green College podcast in the future. So if you don't want your voice to be used in either of those. You don't need to use the mic, and we'll just repeat your question into the mic afterwards, but if you're happy to have your voice recorded for that purpose, I'll just hand you the mic. So give me 1 second, and maybe Val and Hadley, could we maybe take that mic and share it between you to answer the questions? Or Val has to answer all the questions?
Right. Well, it depends. We'll fight over it.
And I'll act as a runabout to hand out the mic for anybody who has questions.
Thank you so much for such a beautiful and informative talk. My question has to do with just your findings at the intersections of youth justice and reformative justice, so to speak, and just questions about how do we start to sort of create space for Indigenous youth, and what have you found so far?
So when the process that we use, we work with communities by invitation, and we start the projects with a workshop, so we teach the methodology that we're going to be using to the community, and often there are youth that are, usually, pretty well everyone, there's been lots of young people, and what we found is that the process is inclusive, because in order to ask questions of a story, you don't need to be completely, you don't need to know all of the laws. It's a way of learning, and questioning the stories and using the stories as tools for thinking and figuring out problems and so on is something that anyone can do, including kids. And kids have done, like little kids have done this work, as well as lots of elders. And one of that, it's an area that's really important to us, because so many young people have been disconnected through no reason of no fault of their own from their communities. And there's often a lack of confidence for how to engage in the questions. They think they have to know more. And so it's been really gratifying to see that dynamic where kids can get in and can ask questions. And one of my favorite examples is up in Gitniau, where we were working with a story of a Haida chief who'd been kidnapped by the Gik'san, and he died during custody and was buried as a chief. And there's, it is a much more complicated story than that. But there was a very young woman there, and she said, "Just a minute, I don't get it. Like, why kidnap him and then bury him like a chief?" And so there was a room like this of all different age of people who then started to talk about why and how come. And it was learning through questioning. It was legal pedagogy in that community. So those are the kinds of things that that are important, as well as fundamentally broadening the idea of law so that people can see that it's a part of the everyday.
Well, my experience is about like the legitimacy of Indigenous law, because it's, you know, we all have experience of interpreting law and processes and putting those into writing and having those become part of the community processes. But if there's one person that disagrees, they run off to court, they appeal, and then it's judged by Western laws. So one of the examples that you gave was about, you know, band governance and these Western ideals of conflict of interest. So from an Indigenous perspective, at least from my community, you're harder on people in your own family. You're harder on people in your own clan. You would have a way harsher punishment than somebody who is outside of your own family. But from a Western lens, there's this idea that you're going to be easier on people from your own family. So all of a sudden, Indigenous processes and laws are being judged from a Western lens. And so when is it that the Western court system says, okay, we feel that you've gone through enough of an administrative process that we're not going to question your findings? We aren't at that place yet, and it's our own people that are questioning the legitimacy of our law and processes. It's not outsiders, it's not non-Indigenous people. That's been my experience. So So I wondered what your feedback was on that.
Oh, and sure, you hand me the mic for this one. No, I'm just kidding. I think it's a really important question, and I think, first of all, it's true, and I think it's and both. It's not either or, right? We can see that in communities where relatives are much harder, or clans are much harder, and we can see where it appears to be related to those deep feelings we have for those we love, right? And I think what ends up happening and what we're advocating for is to be able to make reasoning explicit, to have a reasoned process that relies on principles that may not be Western principles. So if it's, let's say if it's a grandmother or a clan mother who's making the decision, we want to be able to show in something like this of why, because we know not that isn't always the case. Sometimes people would say, no, in this particular instance, on these facts, we need somebody else brought in, right? So we want to be able to make explicit that reasoning process that does happen and be able to explain it. And we want to be able to make explicit the responses that are available and have people's reasoning be there. And so if you got really technical and started talking about standards of reviews and we're talking about this being in front of a federal court judge, ultimately, I am imagining being able to see a federal court judge saying, this might not be principles that I'm familiar with, but I get that they're principles, and I can see enough to see how they were reasoned through. And so I will give them this amount of deference, just like I would give this panel or this tribunal this amount of deference. It's imperfect, but I do think that's where we need to work towards.
And it's early days. Like, there are a number of communities that we're working with now who are moving to implementation, and that means looking at what is the relationship with state law in whatever, like whether it's, again, lands or resources or governance. So insofar as the work we're doing, it's still early days. And these kinds, like the question of legitimacy internally is something that we have to work out with each other. Like, so what is it that we require in a process as well as in substance that will mean we'll adhere to a decision even if we don't get our own way? Like, fundamentally, that's where we need to get to with each other.
I think we have time for one last question.
Thank you. It's a very interesting talk. I'm thinking of the conflict between band councils and the elders when it comes to making decisions on economic projects. And as an outsider, what I perceive, probably incorrectly, is that the band councils are, in fact, rejecting the principles and stories, etc., and saying, well, yes, that was the past, but now we're moving on, we're entering into the white man's economy, we want part of it, and therefore we're going to go ahead with this mine or this pipeline or whatever. Have you addressed those issues at all anywhere?
Well, if I may, we were just having a conversation about this before, weren't we? About not Indigenous governments, but indeed state governments doing the same thing, where there are very cherished principles of rule of law and other legalities that have been held up within England and Europe and Canada and the United States for centuries now, in a span of decades, governments that are focused on economic growth at the expense of that have done their best to undermine. So I think it's one of those perpetual issues that have to do with law and power and economics and spaces of exception that we need to all stay very alert to, Indigenous or non-Indigenous, wherever we're from, if that helps.
And one of the really important things is not to foreclose legal processes with a political ideal. Like, Indigenous peoples have always had to make difficult decisions and need to do so now, and what we're encouraging, what we're saying is that we have to do the homework so that those, so that they have the resources, and we need to support those communities so that there are, so that they are able to deliberately reason through in a principled fashion those hard kinds of decisions that have to do with the economy as well as everything else. So rather than making assumptions about what the outcome of law is, again, law by declarations, that's not where we start. We start with a legal question and how are people going to work through that as citizens. And that's part of citizenry rebuilding.
I want to thank Val and Hadley, and before asking for another round of applause for them, I also want to thank some other folks who have made tonight possible, in particular the folks here at Green College, and in particular Emily Pfister, Alan Gumbach, Principal Essie, for making tonight and this series possible. I'd like to thank the folks at First Nations and Indigenous Studies for helping to publicize tonight's event, and the people at Unceded Airways on CITR who will be rebroadcasting this talk later in December. I'd like to thank all of you for taking the time to be here tonight, and if you're interested in coming back, we'll have more Access to Justice speaker series starting in January, and you can also download this and other podcasts in the series at a later date. We don't have them ready quite yet, but we will soon. And so without anything else, please join me in giving a very warm thank you to Val and Hadley for sharing their time to be here tonight and all of these wonderful ideas.
This is Unceded Airways, broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. You heard a lecture called Access to Justice and Indigenous Laws, organized by Green College UBC. This lecture featured Val Napoleon from the University of Victoria and Hadley Friedland from the University of Alberta. We would like to thank the lecturers for allowing us to share this information to our Unceded Airwaves listeners, and to Green College UBC for allowing us to syndicate this lecture. You may find more information on Green College on their website at greencollege.ubc.ca. We'll post a link to their Access to Justice lecture series in the description of this podcast and on our Unceded Airwaves Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unceded Airwaves.